From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, a special report from the London Conference on Gender Violence in Times of War. UN Envoy Angelina Jolie is leading calls to raise consciousness.
We can end the use of rape and sexual violence as a weapon of war once and for all. We really can do it.
We'll have a full report from day one of the four-day event. Also today, stunning statistics about the depth of poverty in one of the world's most developed nations. Japan's Prime Minister vows his country will try to carry on whaling. And we look at the outlook for a global treaty on climate change after President Obama's moves to limit carbon emissions.
They never like to rush these things, but there is definitely a timetable now in place.
That's ahead on today's FSN Reports after our latest summary of the world news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Five American soldiers have been killed in an apparent friendly fire incident in southern Afghanistan. Afghan officials say coalition forces called in air support when they were attacked by the Taliban at the end of an operation. But the airstrike mistakenly hit their own forces. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
An Afghan soldier and an interpreter were also killed in Monday's attack, which is being investigated by NATO. It's one of the worst friendly fire incidents involving US and coalition troops during the nearly 14-year war. It comes just days before a runoff round in the country's presidential election. Southern Afghanistan is the heartland of the Taliban, and insurgents frequently attack security forces in the region. The deaths bring the number of NATO soldiers killed so far this year in Afghanistan to 36, with 8 killed just this month.
The city of Mosul in northern Iraq has been taken over by Sunni militants. Iraqi army soldiers have abandoned their weapons and uniforms and fled with many thousands of civilians. The militants have freed hundreds of prisoners, seized key military installations, police stations, the main airport, and key government buildings. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has declared a state of emergency across the country. Many of the militants belong to the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria and have been taking advantage of the porous border between the two countries. Namo Abdullah, a correspondent for Ruda Television in Iraqi Kurdistan, says it's a major deterioration in the sectarian conflict.
A very dramatic moment. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki today held an unexpected press conference, canceled his regular schedule to brief the public. And he urged everyone, quote-unquote, everyone who can carry a gun to start resisting the terrorists.
Discussions in Brussels to try to resolve the dispute with Russia over gas supplies to Ukraine and the EU are resuming. Ukraine, Russia, and the EU were supposed to have reached an agreement by the end of Monday, but after 8 hours of talks, no decision was made. Here's Jack Perak from Brussels.
Russian gas giant Gazprom wants Kiev to pay off some of its debts or face a cut in supply. But the Ukrainian government says a doubling in the price of gas by Russia following the crisis is unacceptable. The threat to turn the gas supply off if an agreement between Ukraine, Russia and the EU couldn't be brokered didn't materialise, despite a Monday deadline passing. The EU sees half its Russian gas come through Ukraine, and the supply from Russia makes up a third of the bloc's consumption. Talks will resume Tuesday night in Brussels and could last until Wednesday.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A high school shooting in the U.S. state of Oregon has left at least one student dead in addition to the shooter. There are reports of additional injuries. Rachel Silverman reports.
Police say the shooting happened at about 8 in the morning as students prepared to take final exams at Reynolds High School in Troutdale, about 12 miles east of Portland. They say a semi-automatic weapon was involved. A number of emergency vehicles surrounded the school and the facility was placed on lockdown. Once secure, SWAT teams moved from room to room to take students out safely.
A four-day summit aimed at ending sexual violence in conflict has opened in London. 140 countries are represented, with the UK pushing for concrete action to help eliminate rape as a weapon of war. Dan Whitehead is at the summit in East London.
There are hundreds of charities here, all pushing the same message to eradicate that problem. This four-day summit was opened by the British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, and the Special Envoy for the UN Commissioner for Refugees, Angelina Jolie. There are also real victims of sexual violence who have travelled from conflict zones to London to give first-hand accounts of their harrowing experiences.
Hillary Clinton's new memoir goes on sale in the U.S. today, prompting renewed speculation that she plans to seek the American presidency. The book, called Hard Choices, focuses on Ms. Clinton's time as U.S. Secretary of State. Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
The book weighs in at 656 pages, and many believe it's the surest sign yet that Hillary Clinton will seek the presidency. In the book, she defends her record on the Al-Qaeda attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, her attempt to reset U.S. relations with Russia, and she says she's over Monica Lewinsky.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. We begin today in London at the opening of the largest ever conference on gender violence in times of war. It's a four-day event co-chaired by the British Foreign Secretary William Hague and the UN envoy Angelina Jolie. Its aim, not just to raise consciousness about the spiralling epidemic of sexual violence during wartime, but also to galvanise global action on the issue. FSN's London Bureau will be producing extensive coverage of the conference this week, and it starts now with this report on the opening day by our London correspondent Natalie Powell.
Day one of the four-day summit opened with a joint conference by the co-chairs of this event. The celebrity face of the summit, Angelina Jolie, who's the special envoy for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, speaking with the UK's Foreign Secretary, William Hague. The pair joined forces in 2012, launching the Prevention of Sexual Violence Initiative, a subject that is close to both of their hearts, as Angelina Jolie explained in her opening remarks.
On our way over, we spoke about the women we met recently on our last trip, and in particular one woman who said that she had yet to tell her child that she'd been raped because she was so humiliated and she couldn't bring herself to admit it to him.
This is the biggest gathering on this subject, which aims to address challenges to national and international justice systems in prosecuting these crimes and improve support for victims. The ultimate aim, though, for co-chair William Hague is to prevent the use of sexual violence as a weapon in conflict.
We will see NGOs and civil society from all over the world, many experts in the treatment of survivors, many people who have done years of work on this subject. And this will be the greatest concentration of effort, of discussion and decision ever seen in combating sexual violence in conflict.
Reports of such abuses are plentiful here, with victims attending the conference to tell their own stories. Lily Mangoto Bukolo is currently homeless in the UK after fleeing from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
My story is I was raped in 2004 in my country. And the same day, my daughter, she was killed. Then I fly to UK about my protection, and nobody believe me in the first place.
Her tragic story reflects a common message here, with many campaigners critical of the British government, claiming the government is not supporting those seeking asylum in the UK who are fleeing sexual violence in their own countries, as Natasha Walter from Women for Refugee Women explains.
Too often what we see is that women who've come to this country seeking asylum because they've experienced sexual violence in conflict are disbelieved by the Home Office. They end up being locked up in detention and often deported back to the country where they're at risk.
It's hoped this summit will secure real commitments at home and abroad. Officials from over 150 countries, including Sierra Leone, the DRC and Liberia, are present. And those working in war zones hope they will be listening. Helen Bahati from War Child says using sexual violence as a weapon in war zones needs to be stopped.
Sexual violence affects children in Congo because from the fact that it's a conflict-affected country, people use sexual violence as a gun or to destroy the nation. So they see that the children are the future of a nation, and they start by destroying that future.
Aside from the political meetings taking place this week, the event is open to the public in a bid to further spread the message about ending sexual violence, especially in war zones. Natalie Powell, London.
And we'll have more from the conference in London on tomorrow's edition of the programme. This is FSN Reports. The demand for food aid in Britain has risen dramatically in the last year, according to new research by a consortium of charitable organisations. They found that food bank use in the UK increased by 54% over the previous year, and that the country's food banks served up more than 20 million meals in 2013. In particularly hard-hit parts of the country, demand for food aid has trebled in the last 12 months. The report says food prices in Britain have increased 43.5% over the last 8 years, and incomes aren't keeping up with the rate of price inflation. Krishna Poinasamy is Oxfam's Economic Justice Policy Advisor.
In Britain today, 20 million meals are delivered by food aid charities, you know, over the year, and that's a 54% increase compared to the year before. And, you know, the bottom line is this is an absolute scandal. You know, what kind of country are we living in when, or what kind of world are we living in when in the seventh richest country in the world, we're handing out 20 million meals a year because people aren't able to put food on their table.
And that is significantly more than the previous year. This does seem to be a problem that is getting worse very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so in the previous year, so ending in April 2013, there were 13 million meals distributed, and now that's 20 million meals. And, you know, those drivers are still there. So we're talking the sanctions, the rising cost of living, people working, you know, on insecure contracts and on low wages, and it all combines to people having not enough money to put food on their table. You know, we already know that mothers are skipping meals, but it's beyond that now. There is no food, and people are having to turn to food banks. You know, I went to a food bank last year, actually, in Birmingham, and people are coming in there. The people who have had jobs before, they can't find those jobs anymore. They're being denied social security, partly through sanctions or sometimes through delays to payments. And now the safety net is not there anymore. And the food bank charities, you know, they're having to plug the gaps in the safety net, and that needs to change.
The government would say, though, the economy is improving, and once it filters down to every level of society, this is something that will remedy itself.
Well, I mean, filters down, you know, that trickle-down economics isn't working at the moment, and we can see that day-to-day in food banks. If it was trickling down, then why are those numbers going up?
Food banks, I mean, we've heard reports in the last couple of years that they've been completely overrun, they're overstretched. What happens next? Because surely there's going to be a saturation point where they simply won't be able to meet the demand they have for people coming. What happens then?
I mean, I'm not sure about a saturation point, but the demand is growing. That's for sure. The safety net shouldn't be something that's provided by, the voluntary organisations. They shouldn't be the last resort. The last resort should be that people receive income for times when you've fallen ill, when you've lost your job. You should be given some support to be able to rebuild a sustainable life. That's how things have happened in the past. And now that safety net is failing, the food banks are having to step in. In terms of, you know, can it go on indefinitely, it shouldn't be going on at all. People shouldn't have to turn to food banks. I don't know where that endpoint is. The endpoint needs to be in terms of addressing the actual real causes, and that's what we're actually calling the government to do, is we need to get a hold of this. We can't go on indefinitely. We have to work out a way to get the usage of food banks down.
Do you think that it's going to get much worse? We've already reached this point. How much further do you think this will go?
Well, there are 13 million people living in poverty in the UK today. So those numbers can rise pretty steeply. If the food bank charities are supposed to step in for the government, and you know, if I'm completely honest, I don't think that's what most of the country thinks that the social security system should be. They do think that they're paying their taxes, that there should be a social safety net for when times are hard, and times are beyond hard now. Cupboards are bare, you know, children are missing out on meals, and we need to address this urgently.
That's Krishna Poinasamy, Oxfam's Economic Justice Policy Advisor. Environmental activists are up in arms over a move by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to boost efforts to restart commercial whaling, despite a UN ruling that Tokyo must stop killing whales in the Antarctic. Campaigners hoped a ruling by the International Court of Justice would herald the end of commercial whaling. Phil Klein is an international ocean policy expert with Greenpeace. He was also a commercial fisherman for 30 years, and he told FSN's Nina Maria Potts that the ruling still makes it hard for Japan to hunt whales.
Well, I'm very disappointed that he's sounding like he's lost somewhere in the 20th century and hasn't grasped the new reality. Although Japan has said that they will abide by the International Court of Justice ruling, which means when and if they ever go whaling in the Southern Ocean again, it will be with a scientific program that has gone through the International Whaling Commission's scientific committee to get its blessing that it's truly science, and with the agreement of the International Whaling Commission. So that's actually a relatively high bar that they need to meet, given the extent of the ruling that their past program didn't meet any of the scientific criteria.
I mean, in the public mind, this issue has been running on for years. Greenpeace has certainly been at it for years. I mean, why do you think he is so belligerent? I mean, given the fact that it is such an unpopular thing to be pursuing.
Well, there's obviously in the government of Japan and at their parliamentary level some support for this, in that it takes a lot of Japanese taxpayer subsidies money to have run the program in the past, and whether or not the International Whaling Commission will approve a lethal program that then tries to fund itself on the backs of selling the whale meat and turning it back into a commercial venture, that's still yet to be seen. What we do know, though, is that for this upcoming Southern Ocean summer, which is November, January, February, December, the winter months here in the Northern Hemisphere, there will be no whales hunted in the Southern Ocean for the first time in over a century. So we certainly can celebrate that. And for them to restart any quasi-commercial whaling, the International Court of Justice has put a pretty high bar out there. And Japan has agreed that they would go through the International Whaling Commission with an entirely redesigned program if they actually choose to do that. So in the short term, this looks like pandering to his base. It kind of reminds me of kind of the rhetoric we see out of Tea Party folks here in the U.S., unrealistic statements that just feed a base of support, but not necessarily a broad base of support.
That's Phil Klein, an international ocean policy expert with Greenpeace. Finally on the programme today, FSN Spotlight. And we look at the future for global action on climate change. Last week, President Obama made his move, the White House unveiling executive orders designed to force a 30% cut in carbon emissions from the nation's coal-fired power plants. The Chinese are also now talking about imposing a cap on emissions, and diplomatic negotiations focused on finalising a global agreement on greenhouse gases have also had new life breathed into them. So where's it all going? A question Gideon Ruckman of the Financial Times posed to the newspaper's Washington bureau chief Richard McGregor and its environment correspondent Polita Clark.
this move to try to limit emissions from power plants by 30% by 2030 is really a big deal for the US, which historically has not really done that much on climate change compared with other developed countries. When it comes to China, however, the picture is a little bit murkier. There was a very interesting report that came out on the day after President Obama's launch of these regulations, and suggesting that a senior government advisor in Beijing was saying that there would be an absolute cap on emissions in China's next five-year plan. Unfortunately, it seems as though the reports were a little bit premature. The advisor later told us that he was actually just speaking for himself, and this was his view of what should happen. It had been recommended, but it was by no means yet in policy, and certainly not in the five-year plan.
It's an idea that's doing the rounds, but not agreed on. And meanwhile, there's a negotiations restarting on an international level, yeah?
Yeah, these negotiations have been going on now for, very broadly speaking, for nearly 20 years, really. But most recently, in the last few years, they've been working up to try to come up with a kind of a successor treaty to Kyoto, which hasn't really worked, largely because the US failed to ratify it, and a number of other countries have since fallen by the wayside. And in any event, it only covered emissions from developed world countries. So it never actually included China. China's never had to do anything under it, even though China now is by far the world's biggest emitter. So what countries are now trying to do is come up with a treaty by the end of next year in Paris. I say treaty, a lot of countries prefer to call it an agreement, but in any case, it is supposed to be a global deal to reduce emissions or to tackle climate change, which will be agreed at the end of next year. They never like to rush these things. It's only supposed to come into force from 2020. But there is definitely a timetable now in place where we are eagerly waiting to see what countries are going to be doing, and that's very much the context in which the US power plant emissions rules are being seen.
Now, Richard, as Polita was saying, the US has taken the initiative on this. President Obama talked a good game about climate change when he came in, and then it all seemed to go quiet. So why have things restarted?
Well, you're quite right. He did talk a big game. It's been in both his inaugural addresses. So in some respects, this is a promissory note that he's reissued a number of times, and he's finally called in. I think, number one, he wants to do something. He believes in the science of climate change. He accepts the need to do something. It's a big, big legacy issue for Mr. Obama, and this may be about the last time he can do it. He can do this through executive authority, an authority through the Environmental Protection Agency that was tested through the Supreme Court.
So that means he doesn't have to get congressional approval, presumably makes it much, much easier to get something done.
Well, if he had to get congressional approval, he literally got nothing done because there's simply not the numbers in the House of Representatives with the Republicans, maybe not even in the Senate as well. So frankly, he's quite happy to bypass Congress, and he wants to make a virtue of it as well. And I think also we have to give the White House some credit. I think they've managed this much better than many of their other political initiatives. Climate change has always been about some future, distant, murky sort of disaster, which is very hard to sell people on in their day-to-day lives. And I think over the last 12 months or so, they've tried to reposition it as a public health issue, talking about asthma, about pollution, about particulates in the air. And to some extent, they've had some success in doing that. So they've both been able to do it and perhaps managed it better than many people might have thought.
And where does public opinion stand on all this? I mean, we've had a, it seems, at least from afar, succession of pretty weird weather events in the United States, droughts, wild storms in New York and all of that. Do people believe generally that President Obama is right to act, or is the more, much more sceptical view of the Republicans and the Tea Party more popular?
Well, politically, the Republicans, of course, who were once on board with this and had their own initiatives on climate change, have really gone in the other direction. You know, you've basically got everything from outright denial to genuine scepticism. But beyond that, you know, I think climate change has become, for Republicans, a sort of subset of a larger culture war over government. In other words, it's indelibly associated through some very clever politicking with bigger government, bigger regulation. So Republicans really can't touch this. The public, I think, has an underlying concern about climate change, but when it comes to whether they're willing to pay extra costs in their day-to-day lives, particularly at a time when the economy is weak and the middle class is squeezed and many people are still out of work, well, it becomes a much, much harder sell. So the opportunity is there, but it's still a really difficult public policy issue in the States as it is anywhere in the world.
And Polita, I mean, you alluded to the fact that although America's now taking a lead, it's no longer even the world's largest emitter. That's China. So what are we hoping to see come out of China, and what are the chances of something actually happening?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. The Chinese account for about a third of global emissions now, and the US is around 15-ish percent, depending on which data set you look at. But really, that means that China's got to do an enormous amount if we're to see any change. And it's hard to say if they're undecided, but they appear to be undecided, because there is definitely a view within some parts of the government. I was over in Beijing a few weeks ago talking to people in the NDRC, the Economic Planning Ministry, and various other advisors and climate officials. And there's very much a view that for their own reasons, particularly air pollution concerns, they do want to shift towards a more low-carbon economy, as the jargon has it. But there's also a view that they don't want to be pushed into anything that's going to compromise their economic growth in the direction that they feel is best suited for them. So, and they continually emphasise that they still have tens of millions of people living in poverty. They can't be doing anything that's going to arrest their moves to keep on lifting people out of poverty. So they're in a difficult position in many ways. And in some ways, it's a lot like any country here in Europe or in the US, any developed or industrialized country, where different parts of the government, different parts of business have different views on how to tackle this. So it's definitely clear that the leadership, rhetorically at least, are saying that they want to do something. I would be surprised if in the next five-year plan there wasn't something much more adventurous and ambitious than what we've seen previously.
Now, it's often said that maybe we don't need a huge international deal covering all 190 or whatever it is members of the United Nations. If you could just get a US-China deal, which collectively would cover almost half the emissions in the world, is that right? Then you'd do it. I mean, A, is that right, yeah, that US-China's the key? And B, any possibility?
It's absolutely correct, really. It's highly politically incorrect to say this, and neither the US or China like to say it aloud because it offends everybody else. But the truth is, you can't have a deal unless you have these two countries agreeing on something. And the interesting thing here is that since John Kerry has become US Secretary of State, the US has really pushed on this a lot, because I think it's not just Obama. This is not a legacy issue just for him. It's also for John Kerry, who's been incredibly interested in climate change his whole career, really. He's set up this dialogue between the US and China on climate change. They've had several meetings. They're very detailed. Some European negotiators here are sort of privately complaining that they don't really know what's going on. There's a bit of concern that the US and China could come up with a deal that's not really as ambitious as a lot of countries would like, particularly here in Europe, where these countries have really been traditionally the leaders on this. But what's interesting is that it's happening at all. They are discussing each other's targets. There's still a lot of hurdles, but it's very clear that I think the US in particular, and some parts of the Chinese administration, would very much like to see some sort of agreement before the end of next year.
Polita Clark, the environment correspondent of the Financial Times, alongside Richard McGregor, the Washington bureau chief for the newspaper. You can read their reporting every day in the paper and online at ft.com. And they were talking to the FT's foreign affairs commentator, Gideon Ruckman. And that's FSN Reports for another day. Don't forget, we'd like to hear from you. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also interact with us on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. I'm Simon Marks in Washington for everyone with Feature Story News everywhere. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again tomorrow. Goodbye.